Good morning, everyone! Who wants to kick off show and tell?
Me!
Aw, man!
Okay, Demi, what do you have for us?
So, I have this super awesome cup that belonged to my founder, Helga Hufflepuff, and it's golden and...
Wait a minute! My soul's in that!
Now, Tom, let's not be silly.
I said my soul's in that! Give it back!
Oh no, it must be a Horcrux.
This podcast is the property of
the Half-Blood Princesses.
I'm Demi.
I'm Jess.
The story will begin in a flourish. Hello everyone, welcome to episode 16 of the Half-Blood Princesses. We are super duper happy to be back again.
Yes, we are. And if you don't follow us on social media, what the heck are you doing with your life? We have Twitter and Instagram at HB Princesses Pod and Facebook and YouTube, the Half-Blood Princesses, a Harry Potter podcast. Also, you can leave us a voicemail at 412-228-5435. So Demi, what's the topic of magical episode number 16?
Our topic is Horcruxes, and joining us today is the fabulous Mike Schubert from Potterless.
Hello, thanks so much for having me. It's fun to be here.
Thank you for being here. We're super, super excited. So do you want to tell everybody your Wizarding World profile?
Sure. So to give you the rundown, my house is Gryffindor. My wand, according to the quiz at wizardingworld.com, the website formerly known as Pottermore, is a dogwood wand with a unicorn hair core. It's 14 and a half inches, and it has pliant flexibility. I have no idea what that means about me as a person, but there it is. My Patronus is a fox. My favorite book is The Sixth Half-Blood Prince. My favorite character is Ginny, and my favorite class is Arithmancy because I liked physics in school, and I liked math, and I really am interested to know what it is, and they never tell us anything about it in the books. So I'm forever wondering what Arithmancy actually involves.
Yeah, I really wish they told us more about that, especially like ancient runes too. I was so interested, and they're like, oh, she's just poring over a translation. I'm like, what does that mean?
Right.
But we are so excited to have you. I'm fangirling and trying not to like jump out of my seat right now. I'm so excited to have you.
I am just a boy who did not read books and then did. Don't worry.
So with that, let's get into our Horcruxes quote.
It's time for Quick Quotes Corner. Today's quote comes from chapter 23 of Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, called Horcruxes. Yes, sir, said Riddle. I don't understand, though. Just out of curiosity, I mean, would one Horcrux be much use? Can you only split your soul once? Wouldn't it be better, make you stronger, to have your soul in more pieces? I mean, for instance, isn't 7 the most powerfully magical number? Wouldn't 7... Merlin's beard, Tom, yelled Slughorn. 7? Isn't it bad enough to think of killing one person? And in any case, bad enough to divide the soul, but to rip it into 7 pieces?
It is very clear from this conversation that Tom Riddle isn't asking Slughorn about Horcruxes out of curiosity. All along, he planned on making more than one Horcrux, but he just needed more information about them. This conversation ultimately leads to Tom's big question about whether or not it'd be powerful enough to only split your soul once, and wouldn't it be better to rip it into more than one piece, 7 to be exact, the magical number. Obviously, Tom was very troubled even as a student and had his mind set on the dark arts and being all powerful. Still, his plan didn't actually work out. Harry becoming a Horcrux wasn't part of the plan, and therefore, Voldemort's soul was ripped into 8 pieces, not 7, the 8th living inside of him. The magical number 7 in terms of the number of Horcruxes wasn't on his side, which Voldemort didn't anticipate. I think this shows a lot about Voldemort's ignorance and thinking he is all-powerful and invincible, which he's not. And this ignorance ultimately leads to his downfall once and for all.
I agree with you. I don't think anybody can be invincible because he still has 7 other pieces of himself lying around. Like, anybody could open it and destroy it, right? Harry being anybody. And honestly, you're going to use them up. Like, let's say they stayed intact. He's going to use them up over time. So all he achieved really is longevity of life, not like immortality, which is the whole thing that he thinks he's going to achieve. And also his humanity is busted because you basically kill someone every time you make a Horcrux. And your soul is part of you as a human. So if your soul is split, your humanity is split. And the evil part of your conscience basically overwhelms you because you murdered all these people.
Exactly, yeah, and Dumbledore even says that to Harry, like, not to be mistaken that Voldemort is a weaker wizard with his soul ripped. That doesn't take away his power, it just makes him less human. And we even see that in his appearance. He becomes more snake-like and has this overwhelming evil that seems to be all he is. And so I think that shows in the character Voldemort that we see throughout the series, how he is very inhuman. And ultimately, he ends up dying at the end because all of his Horcruxes get destroyed, which wasn't part of his plan either. And we see that he isn't invincible, and Harry was able to defeat him.
Yeah, and if you think about it too, the only invincible person in this entire series was Nicholas Flamel because he had the Elixir of Life. And he knew that it also had risks, so that's why he destroyed it.
Exactly. I think that's a really great comparison, and seeing the different uses of these powerful objects, looking at Horcruxes and the Sorcerer's Stone, essentially, and how Voldemort and Nicholas Flamel approach the situation differently. And I think that shows a lot about their characters.
OMG, I think Polly's coming, and she's bringing us the Sword of Gryffindor to destroy Hufflepuff's cup, which we have in our possession. Aw, man, it's just the fun facts.
Hey, it's Polly, our owl. She's flying in with the fun facts.
Thank you so much, Polly, for bringing these Horcrux fun facts. Let's get into it. So a Horcrux is any object in which a dark wizard had concealed part of their soul. As long as a Horcrux is kept safe, the wizard will continue to exist even if their body is damaged or destroyed. Essentially, the goal is to attain immortality. Let's talk about Voldemort's seven Horcruxes in turn, starting with the diary. Tom had the diary while he was still a student at Hogwarts. After opening the Chamber of Secrets, he used the Basilisk to kill Myrtle Warren, aka Moaning Myrtle. Her death resulted in Tom Riddle's first Horcrux, the diary. He gave the diary to Lucius Malfoy for safekeeping, but he slipped the diary to Ginny Weasley, thus getting it back into Hogwarts. While at Hogwarts during her first year, we know the whole situation that goes down in Book 2 of the Harry Potter series, but eventually Harry destroys it with a basilisk fang in the Chamber of Secrets. Now let's talk about Marvolo Gaunt's ring. It is a large finger ring that was clumsily made with what appeared to be gold. It was set with a black stone engraved with the Peverell coat of arms, marking it as the Resurrection Stone. The ring has a link to Voldemort's family. Even though Voldemort left the Muggle orphanage and went to Hogwarts, he still felt a strong resentment toward his parents. As a teenager, he went to his mother's former home and met his uncle Morfin, who was wearing the ring. Morfin revealed Tom's father's location, and Tom killed him, making the Horcrux. Along with killing his father, he also killed his grandparents too, just to do it, and then modified Morfin's memory so he confessed to the murders. Later, Dumbledore acquired the ring and destroyed it with the Sword of Gryffindor, which became a method of Horcrux destruction after the whole ordeal with Harry in the Chamber of Secrets, because it now has basilisk venom. Moving on, let's talk about Hufflepuff's cup. It's a small, magical, golden cup with two finely wrought handles engraved with a badger. The cup was passed down through Hufflepuff's descendants until it ended up with Hepzibah Smith. At the time, Voldemort was working for Borgin and Birks, and Hepzibah showed him both Hufflepuff's cup and Slytherin's locket. 2 days after this encounter, Hepzibah was found dead, and her house elf, Hokey, seemed to remember poisoning Hepzibah's cocoa. Obviously, Hokey's memory was modified, the same way Morfin's was. So, Hufflepuff's cup was made a Horcrux with Hepzibah Smith's death. The cup was given to Bellatrix Lestrange for safekeeping, and it was kept in the Lestrange's vault at Gringotts. It was destroyed by Hermione Granger with a basilisk fang in the Chamber of Secrets. Next up is Slytherin's locket. It's a heavy gold locket carrying Salazar Slytherin's mark, a serpentine S. Like Malvolio Gaunt's ring, Slytherin's locket is tied to Voldemort's family. His mother, Merope, stole the locket from her family's home and fled to London, where she pawned it out of desperation. Eventually, the locket found its way to Hepzibah's possession. After Voldemort stole it from her, he killed a homeless muggle to turn it into a Horcrux. Voldemort hid it in a cave, protected by dark magic and Inferi. Regulus Black and Creature were first to breach the cave's defenses. This is when Regulus Black swapped the real locket for the fake one that Harry and Dumbledore found. Creature returned to Grimmauld Place and attempted to destroy the locket, under Regulus's orders, but he wasn't successful in doing this. It was then stolen by Mundungus Fletcher and then given to Dolores Umbridge. This locket got passed around a lot. So the Golden Trio managed to break into the Ministry of Magic by using Polyjuice Potion, and they retrieved the locket from Umbridge, and then Harry was able to open it by speaking Parseltongue, and Ron destroyed it with the Sword of Gryffindor. Now let's talk about Ravenclaw's diadem. It's a tiara that bestows wisdom upon the wearer, and it's etched with the words, "Wit beyond measure is man's greatest treasure." The lost diadem captivated Ravenclaws for centuries. Voldemort used his talent of manipulation on Rowena Ravenclaw's daughter, Helena, and she revealed the whole story of how she stole it from her mother and hid it in Albania. Voldemort traveled to Albania to retrieve the diadem, and he killed a peasant to turn it into a Horcrux. Voldemort then went to Hogwarts, seeking a teaching position that he didn't get, but while he was there, he hid it in the Room of Requirement. While the Battle of Hogwarts was occurring, Vincent Crabbe unleashed Fiendfire in the Room of Hidden Things, which destroyed the diadem. Let's talk about Nagini. Voldemort used his creepy pet snake and the death of Bertha Jorkins to create the Horcrux. This is super interesting on Voldemort's part to make Nagini a Horcrux because of her connection to Slytherin, being a snake and all. So she was super useful to Voldemort all the way up until when Neville Longbottom beheaded her with the Sword of Gryffindor. She's also fascinating because this shows that a living thing can be a Horcrux, and she's not the only living thing that became a Horcrux, because so was Harry Potter. Shocking, Voldemort, look what you did. So the night that Voldemort tried to kill Harry in Godric's Hollow, he left Harry with more than just his lightning-shaped scar. When Voldemort tried to kill infant Harry, the curse backfired, and thus a piece of Voldemort's soul detached itself from the hole and latched onto Harry's. This is why Harry was able to see into Voldemort's mind and had some abilities that he shared with Voldemort. Voldemort destroyed his own Horcrux in Harry when he cast Avada Kedavra in the Forbidden Forest. Harry being a Horcrux is super fascinating because Albus Dumbledore concluded that Voldemort seeked to create a Horcrux that belonged to each of the four Hogwarts founders. He had Slytherin's locket, Hufflepuff's cup, and Ravenclaw's diadem. He wasn't successful in turning the Sword of Gryffindor into a Horcrux, but it's actually really ironic because it became a Horcrux destroyer. But on the other hand, Harry was sorted into Gryffindor, so in a way, Voldemort created a Gryffindor Horcrux by mistake. Let's wrap up by talking about Professor Quirrell. I bet you guys didn't see that one coming. Well, truth is, Professor Quirrell was technically a Horcrux at one point. In Sorcerer's Stone, we saw the whole creepy thing where Voldemort's face was on the back of Quirrell's head and he was talking to Harry and all that while he was getting the Sorcerer's Stone, and that's all I'm saying about that because I don't want to think about the whole face on the back of the head anymore because it creeps me out. But anywho, he was actually a Horcrux for a period of time because he did host part of Voldemort's soul. But the reason why that piece of soul didn't die like the other Horcruxes is because it left Quirrell's body before Quirrell died, and therefore it wasn't destroyed because the vessel, aka Quirrell's body, wasn't destroyed first. Interesting, huh? I hope you thought that was interesting, because now we're going to talk all about the Horcruxes in very great detail with our extra fabulous guest, Mike Schubert from Potterless.
Now, it's time to dive into the book topic of the week, for Tales of Magic and Mischief.
So, I am up first to discuss the Horcrux that is Tom Riddle's diary, which is an interesting one. I've always found the diary to be interesting in that in the second book, which is my least favorite book, and especially for my going through of the series, because famously, if anyone's listened to Potterless, I didn't read the books as a kid, so it's me doing it as an adult. And the second book just felt very, very strange and boring. But while I was doing it and saying this on my podcast, people were pointing out to me, like, don't worry, it becomes more important. And like, the second book is all about planting the seed and stuff like that. So I can see how later on, like, maybe the second book isn't the most interesting, but because the diary becomes more than just like a vessel for a villain to exist in the second book, it ends up becoming so much more once we get into Horcruxes. I could see why people have a love for either the whole second book or specifically the diary. I do think it's interesting that it's something that was like originally introduced and just like on its own has some cool magic with writing into it, and then the text disappears, and you know, it happening to Ginny, who's going through, like, she goes through a hell of a situation with the diary, to then go to the point where Harry is like flashback travel through timing to see the memories of Tom Riddle, and then eventually he's able to come out of the diary and end up possessing Ginny and trying to get him to come back into life and be a real boy. It's interesting how, I think of all the other Horcruxes, this one has the most, it feels like the most evil. I guess the Locket does some really cool stuff too in the seventh book with all of the stuff it tries to like mess with Ron and all of that. But this is a very powerful one. And I've always been intrigued about like what exactly Tom Riddle had to do to this book to establish everything that exists. And then I will say it's one of the cooler destruction ones. The fact that it gets destroyed by Harry just jabbing it through with a basilisk fang, I think is very fun. But I don't know how you all feel about the diary.
I definitely think it's super interesting that it can truly take over somebody completely, like we see with Ginny. And what I think is so interesting about that is this is a diary. And whether or not Tom actually wrote in it or not, diaries are very personal things. So looking at a diary and a person, they're tied together so closely that for somebody else to pick that diary up and write in it is truly tying you to that other person. And eventually we see how it kind of possesses Ginny in a way. So it's definitely dangerous in that regard, and also very interesting.
What I've always wondered, though, is how many entries Ginny wrote into this diary, because they say, oh, she wrote in it all year long and she poured her soul out into it. But it's like, is there a set number of times you have to write in it to pour your soul out into it? Because it's almost like your blood is the ink instead of the actual ink. That's what I picture. It seems visceral to me. Almost like the pen from Umbridge, where she's like, oh, you must not tell lies. That's what I picture when I hear, oh, you poured your soul into this diary. And the way that Ginny looks so pale at the end, that's what I pictured. I just would love to know more about the enchantment behind it.
Yeah, I think that's always been the most interesting thing to me is the process of what Tom Riddle had to do to make it, because it feels like there had to have been a lot of different spells in order to do it. Like, it doesn't just seem like one thing. It seems like more than just a standard Horcrux. If you want to say that, I don't know, Hufflepuff's cup is just a standard one in that it has the soul keeping aspects to it, but this one has like legitimate evil powers in it that goes beyond just a vessel for Voldemort's soul. So I think that's pretty interesting. I also like that it's, I don't know if this is a British versus American thing, but the fact that Tom Riddle, a boy, still calls it a diary, I think is fun, because at least like for boys my age growing up, it was always like, oh no, it's a journal, it's not a diary, because journals are cool and diaries are for girls, which is like very of the time when I grew up. So I don't know if that's a culture difference thing, but I did always think it was kind of funny. And then a Harry Potter musical makes fun of it in a very fun way. But the fact that it is specifically a diary always made me chuckle a bit.
So the other thing, like going off of it being a diary, what we see with it too is like the communication. Like you were saying, Mike, how it's not just a standard Horcrux, like it's actually communicating back. And I've always found that interesting because it's almost like that's so much more than just a piece of your soul or Voldemort's soul, because it's actually able to absorb the ink and basically figure out what the person's writing to actually write back, which has always been super creepy to me.
Oh, definitely.
It also makes me wonder, I'm just kind of like, well, if the diary was the first Horcrux he made, then maybe he's like, oh, I made this one too powerful. Maybe I'll just make the rest of them, you know, generic.
Yeah, maybe he got lazy. He was like, ugh, the diary took so much work. Here, the cup, just my soul, nothing else. No extra features.
There's a lot of unanswered questions, especially with the diary. And the whole thing with it being destroyed with the Basilisk Fang, I think is super interesting because at that time, like, we just think it's a poisonous, you know, fang from this basilisk, but seeing how it's powerful enough to destroy a Horcrux is, like, super fascinating.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It truly is, and since the diary reminds me and is supposed to be, like, a person, I always wonder if it would have mattered if it was a different page that he stabbed. Like, where's the heart of the book? You know what I mean?
It's
gotta
be right in the middle.
Like, what, in the middle? It's like, oh, the middle's the heart.
I would think if you just get the basilisk fang in there, it's it. I mean, and this is always like, there's that meme that goes around where it's like, oh, you know, the basilisk fang destroyed the book. Why didn't it destroy Harry? And I'm just here to set the record straight that it's because Harry didn't get fully destroyed, whereas the basilisk fang fully destroyed the book. All the ink goes out of it and it is completely wrecked. Like the entire vessel has to be completely destroyed. And the fact that Harry didn't die makes him not completely destroyed.
That's interesting. I never thought about that way.
I was forced to because people send me that meme like once a week. So I had to come up with a reply.
I just think it's gross how the ink just like pours out of it. I always wonder how much it was because it's like, think of all the people who've written in it. It's like, oh, there's like gallons of ink that just fell on top of you. Like, that's so gross. So the next Horcrux we have is the ring. So when Dumbledore comes to pick up Harry from the Dursleys in Half-Blood Prince, he sees Dumbledore's hand, which is blackened and shriveled. It looked as though his flesh had been burned away. And then we see the actual ring. Later, when they go to visit Slughorn, Harry sees the ring on Dumbledore's uninjured hand. It was large, rather clumsily made, of what looked like gold, and was set with a heavy black stone that had cracked down the middle. What did you think of the ring when you first saw it?
I'm trying to remember. I mean, I'm sure it's on the podcast. I definitely didn't think Resurrection Stone initially. I feel like later on it became clear, but I didn't really know. I remember I thought that... I remember thinking that the hand thing wasn't like the curse of him like putting it on and everything. I remember I thought that Dumbledore's burnt hand was because he tried to use like extreme fire magic to destroy the ring. So I think my brain's fan theories were less concerned about the ring. I was more fascinated with the burnt hand, and I thought Dumbledore was trying to kill it because it was a Horcrux, and that's how we got the injury.
That's really interesting because I'm actually the opposite of that. I was really fascinated by the ring. Okay. And making the connection like Dumbledore's wearing this ring. And then making the connection like, oh, Dumbledore's hand's burnt. What if there's some kind of curse? So I kind of made that connection. Oh. Granted, I had no clue, like, anything that was a Horcrux, but I kind of got the feeling that there was some dangerous curse surrounding the ring.
Nice. Well done. I'm bad at predicting things, as we all know, so I was way off base.
I agree with Demi. I was fascinated by the ring because... I guess I'm a stereotypical girl because I like jewelry, and I was like, ooh, this is pretty and different. Why is a guy wearing a ring that's like big and old and gross looking? Like, it's cracked. Who wants a ring that's cracked? That was my question. And then yeah, I was like, oh, well, his hand is blackened. Did he blacken his hand trying to destroy it, or did he blacken his hand from wearing it? That was my original question. So later, Harry and Dumbledore travel into the Pensieve, and he glimpses Marvolo Gaunt wearing the ring with the Peveril coat of arms on it. Afterwards, Harry sees the cracked ring in Dumbledore's office. He confirms that it was indeed Marvolo's ring that Dumbledore acquired a few days before he picked up Harry from the Dursleys, and it was around the time he injured his hand. So now, readers finally know that the two events are related. Dumbledore refuses to elaborate on the matter. The mystery of the ring continues. So, what were your thoughts when you finally realized that it was Marvolo Gaunt's ring that Dumbledore had?
Definitely some dark Slytherin connection to that. Because in the Pensieve trip, we know Marvolo Gaunt is like the worst Slytherin ever, one of them. And he has this ring, and now all of a sudden, Dumbledore had it. And we know Marvolo Gaunt was related to Voldemort. So there was definitely that really sinister kind of connection there.
Yeah, for me, it was definitely a moment, because I'm a big fan of big reveals, plot twists, all kind of stuff like that. So the fact that the reveal led to a character that we knew before, especially tying up all the things with the backstory, I found it very interesting. I really enjoy just all of the Horcrux stuff, and that's why it's very fun that I'm on for this discussion for this episode. Like, I think the Horcrux plot is a really fun element, and it's a major factor in why the sixth book is my favorite. Is I think it's really compelling, and it's almost like when you look at the MCU and they start to do all of the Infinity War stuff. Like, it basically is the most important plot-y thing. Like, it's the beginning of the end of Voldemort. So I thought all of it was really interesting, from learning what the Horcruxes are to, like, all of the backstory from the particular items, and then getting to learn the backstory of how Tom Riddle and his family ties into everything. I remember just one that the ring reveal was one of the first ones where you kind of get, like, it's more than just this thing keeping Voldemort alive. And I thought it was really cool.
Yeah, Mike, I completely agree with you, because when you think about it, like, we don't know much about Voldemort until the sixth book. You know, Harry's growing up in books 1 through 3, I feel like. And then in book 4, it's like, oh, he's back, we gotta confront him. And then book 5, it's like, oh, we confronted him and it didn't really work out for us. And then book 6 is like, but we really need to confront this guy because he's going to kill everyone. So we should might as well learn a lot about Voldemort. So it's like, I feel like the first couple books are just Harry growing up. And then when Harry gets older, it gets more interesting and darker. And I think I like the darker side of Harry Potter a lot.
I agree with that. And I also think it's really interesting how the Pensieve is used as the means of relaying this information. That's why it's one of my favorite objects, because it's so fascinating how they're able to go into the memories. And it's not just Dumbledore telling Harry, hey, I talked to this person, I think this is a Horcrux. I talked to this person, this might be a Horcrux. Like, Harry's actually able to relive those moments in time when these Horcruxes are presented, and the ring is one of those. And I think that's super awesome.
Yeah, I love it. It's definitely a really cool plot device, and I'm obsessed with what the substance is that's in there. Because they're like, oh, it's gas, but it's liquid, but it's white. And I'm just like, but what is it? I like to know the ingredients behind the gunk that, like, flows into this thing. All right, so that's it for Half-Blood Prince. We don't learn anything until stuff hits the fan in Deathly Hallows. While camping, the trio get Phineas Nigellus's picture to spill the tea that Dumbledore used the Sword of Gryffindor to crack open the ring, and this situation becomes clear when Harry views Snape's memories in the Pensieve. Again with the Pensieve. Harry finds himself standing in Dumbledore's office at nighttime. Dumbledore is sagged sideways in the throne-like chair behind the desk, apparently semi-conscious, his right hand dangled over the side, blackened and burned. Snape is desperately trying to revive Dumbledore, muttering incantations, pointing his wand at Dumbledore's wrist, and tipping a goblet full of thick golden potion down his throat. Dumbledore comes to, and Snape asks him why he put on the ring. Obviously, Dumbledore had to know that it carried a curse. We see the cracked ring on Dumbledore's desk here, with the Sword of Gryffindor beside it. Answering Snape's question, he said he was tempted. When Snape asks by what, Dumbledore doesn't answer. Snape is furious at this point, telling Dumbledore it was a miracle he got back here, and that the curse, while powerful, is contained in one hand for the time being. Dumbledore asks how long he has, and Snape says a year, as the curse strengthens over time. Dumbledore has the weirdest reaction to his death sentence. He smiles and says he's fortunate to have Snape. They have a little bit more back and forth, and Snape asks Dumbledore if he thought breaking the ring would break the curse. Dumbledore says something like that. He's not giving up the Horcruxes thing to anyone, not even Snape. But Harry knows the truth. We know now that the ring is a Horcrux, and that Dumbledore destroyed it, and that the ring is also the Resurrection Stone. Dumbledore put it on because he was tempted by that, but could the ring also have had a persuasion enchantment on it?
That's what I thought it was. I thought it was similar to the locket. Like, the locket doesn't necessarily tell you to put it on, but the locket has some sort of evil power where, you know, it makes you feel worse and makes you angry. I thought that the ring had an evil thing in it that wanted to tempt you to put it on. Otherwise, Dumbledore wouldn't have done it. And maybe because it is linked to the Resurrection Stone, it's got some sort of evil, because, like, kind of the locket knew what would set Ron off the most. I would think that the ring maybe has some evil where maybe it can, like, sense regret, and then it tells you the regrets that you have and stuff like that. So maybe it talked to Dumbledore and made him want to feel bad about, you know, the situation that happened in the past, so much so that he would put the ring on.
I definitely think the main thing that kind of persuaded Dumbledore to put it on was it being the Resurrection Stone, because I just think that stone being so powerful and being one of the Deathly Hallows is something that kind of brings back loved ones in a way, but not completely. And Dumbledore and the whole trauma from losing Ariana and that whole situation kind of could have persuaded him to put it on. So I think it's a mix of the power of the Resurrection Stone and the persuasion from the Horcrux and the dark magic surrounding it.
And it's also interesting here because both the ring and the diary are similar, because the curse strengthens over time. So the curse and the ring strengthens, and then you die, and then as you write in the diary, your soul goes away. And this is like a gradual thing. So it always makes me wonder whether he did this on purpose.
Yeah, again, not knowing about, like, all of what went into the Horcrux creation, I think could be a really interesting thing of what all the plan was behind the extra things beyond just the standard trying to separate my soul kind of business.
So now let's talk about Slytherin's locket. So at the end of Half-Blood Prince, Dumbledore and Harry go to the cave where Dumbledore believes a Horcrux is hidden. After all they do to get the locket and Dumbledore getting killed by Snape on the Astronomy Tower, it turns out that the locket was a fake. How terrible. And there's a piece of parchment inside it, and this is what it says. To the Dark Lord, I know I will be dead long before you read this, but I want you to know that it was I who discovered your secret. I have stolen the real Horcrux and intend to destroy it as soon as I can. I face death in the hope that when you meet your match, you will be mortal once more. R.A.B. So how did you guys react after this whole situation and knowing that Harry went through all this just to get a fake Horcrux and get a note like this?
Once it revealed that there was a note, I was like, oh, not real. Like right away, I was like, no. But so obviously it's upsetting that you go through all that just for a fake one. However, again, loving a plot twist, loving a big reveal, the RAB thing was very interesting. And then immediately I was trying to think of any character that had RB for initials. And the first one that came to mind was Regulus. Especially because once the gang tries to figure out what or who RAB could be, and they're bringing up like different possibilities, they don't say Regulus Black. So that's when I knew confirmed that it had to be, that they wouldn't even bring it up, even though they knew he existed. I was like, oh, okay, this is JK waiting to do the reveal. So I was proud of myself for predicting that one. But yeah, I mean, I thought it was cool. I mean, it was process of elimination, and the fact that they didn't bring up the one person we definitely knew had an RB name, I was like, that's mad suspicious.
See, I was really little when I read these for the first time, and I, you know, mm-hmm. you both read them when you were older, so yeah. I was just sitting here going, Rab, 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 who's Rab? Like, I didn't even read it as R-A-B. I was a little kid going, who the heck is Rab? Like, so I didn't even put any of that together. But as an adult and reading this now, I'm like, oh, this guy is really clever. You know, he did this as a slap in his face, which is fantastic. Now, granted, because these are the last two books of Harry Potter and we know that someone is supposed to die in these books. Obviously, the loss of Dumbledore was terrible, but we knew it was coming. I mean, the guy is what, over 100 years old? So I just thought it was like super tragic and I cried, to be honest with you. But I cried more at Sirius's death, I will admit. But it's just the pattern that the books were in, because it's like, all right, fourth book Cedric, fifth book Sirius, sixth book Dumbledore, last book everybody dies.
Yeah, honestly. It was definitely super tragic, and the trio have to go on the quest of trying to figure out who RAB is. Obviously, they realize that it's Sirius Black's brother, Regulus, and after making this connection, having Creature share the tragic tale, and learning that Mundungus Fletcher took the locket from Grimmauld Place and gave it to Umbridge, the trio come up with their ministry break-in, where they have to go get the locket back, which they are successful in doing. The trio try many methods of opening the locket without much luck, but there's something odd about the locket that it seems to have a beating, and it's described as having a metal heart. This is super interesting because, as we've seen with the other Horcruxes we talked about so far, there's a negative effect to them. What do you think is so unique about the locket that when you wear it, it's literally right beside your heart, and it has this power control over you, as we will see?
It's really scary. Yep. It scares the crap out of me, to be honest with you, because it's like, it has its own beating heart, it has its own pulse. So it's almost like another person is sitting on you, right? Because it's like, oh, there's someone else. It's like when you're hugging someone and you can feel their heartbeat, but in this sense, it's like a strangling heartbeat. It freaks me out. That locket just scares the crap out of me.
Always one of the things that bugged me with the whole locket changing your mood and stuff. I always found it very strange that they decided to keep wearing it and not put it inside of like the little pouch that Hagrid gave to Harry or Hermione's bag of holding. Like, I understand wanting to keep it on your person and keep track of it, but that's why I felt like Hagrid's pouch was the perfect solution. The fact that they still kept wearing it even when they realized, after when they realized that that is what it does to you, felt like such a silly decision to me.
It probably would have hurt less if you just put it in your pocket. You could still have it on your person, but it's not around your neck.
It just felt like there were other solutions for sure.
I agree. But at the same time, they were probably like so nervous to let it out of their sight because this was the first Horcrux that.
Yeah, they're kids. I get it. Like, that was another thing about me reading it as an adult is like, I've made bad decisions at age 16. Like, of course they didn't think of the most logical solution. It's going to happen.
Yeah. So moving on, we just talked about how there were negative effects, and some of those include Harry not being able to catch a Patronus, and Ron being in a super pissed off mood when he's wearing it. So fast forwarding to when it's destroyed, which is one of my favorite parts in the series. So Harry is approached by the Silver Doe while he's keeping watch outside the tent, and it leads him to a pool of water where the Sword of Gryffindor is. After using the Findo, Harry cracks the ice and gets into the pool while still wearing the locket around his neck. Luckily, Ron saves his ass and gets him out before he drowns, but the locket was trying to strangle him this whole time because it sensed that the Sword of Gryffindor was nearby. So what do you guys think about how the locket reacted when it was close to the Sword of Gryffindor?
I think it's the second most intelligent Horcrux after the diary, because the diary had a full person coming out of it, and the locket has, like, as you'll talk about, Voldemort's eyes and everything. So it's like highly intelligent. I don't think the other Horcruxes would have been like, oh, I'm close to death. This one is like the third coolest because of its intelligence.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely up there. It we've already talked about the evil, but yeah, when you add on this extra element to it, it has, you know, like offensive powers and defensive powers too. So I would agree that it's one of the more advanced ones, and we didn't necessarily see this kind of behavior out of the other Horcruxes. So it was very interesting.
It definitely is, and let's talk about that crazy behavior. So Harry realizes that he needs to speak Parzel tongue to open it. Duh, he should have realized this like a couple chapters ago.
It's Harry we're talking about.
Like, honestly. But Harry puts it on a rock and tells Ron that he's going to be the one to stab it. Ron is like, no, this thing's bad for me. It's worse for me than you and Hermione. It makes me think stuff and worse. Like, Ron is like, I do not want to do this. But Harry doesn't really give him a choice because he's like, I'm opening this and you're stabbing it. So once it's open, Voldemort's eyes appear in the windows and Voldemort's voice speaks to Ron, saying terrible things, his deepest insecurities, and worst thoughts. Then eventually, distorted figures of Harry and Hermione rise out of the locket and continue these terrible things. Once Hermione tells Ron that he's nothing compared to Harry and kisses Harry, Ron has an anguished look on his face and he stabs the locket. But before he does this, Harry sees what he thinks is a glint of scarlet in Ron's eyes. So obviously, Ron destroyed the Horcrux, but it affected him way worse than Harry and Hermione. Why do you think this was the case?
I think it's a personality thing. I think we've seen that Ron is a bit temperamental and especially insecure about the relationship between Harry and Hermione. So I think the locket just knows exactly the right buttons to push to make Ron go over the edge. And I think they just pushed them perfectly. He also was the most frustrated at the situation. Like, he was homesick and he was hungry and he didn't enjoy the camping and the searching and all of that. So I think the combination of his personality with Ron really being out of his element in this exact moment, I think just led to Ron being more likely to fall under the evil spell of the locket.
Yeah, and the other scary thing about this locket is that since it's touching your heart, it knows your heart's deepest fears, desires, and insecurities. And so that's what causes it to give Ron these thoughts and to actually show it to him through the locket, because in lockets, there's usually pictures. It's just a really clever use of the evil power that Voldemort has. Like, this one is pretty darn clever.
It definitely is, yeah. Super creepy. Now let's move on to Hufflepuff's cup. My founder's object. So the first time we see Hufflepuff's cup is in Half-Blood Prince during the Pensieve trips. We see it in a memory with Hexabeth Smith, Hokey the House Elf, and Voldemort. Before we dive into the whole Gringotts break-in and how it is destroyed, let's talk about the cup in general. What do you think would happen if you drank out of it?
Oh, maybe it could be like one of those, it could be similar, just like a non-bad version of the thing in Voldemort's cave, where like you fill it with a liquid and then it doesn't run out. So you could just like fill it with chocolate milk and now you have infinite chocolate milk until you do some sort of spell to make it go away. I would enjoy that.
Oh, I love chocolate milk. I really want chocolate. And our listeners know my feelings on chocolate. Mike's right. It's like the Horn of Plenty. Right? So it has to keep giving you food, just like, you know, because the Hufflepuffs live by the kitchen, so there has to be food near them at all times.
Yeah.
So it has to keep giving you food. But my thought process went to her asking, like, what it would do if you drank out of it when you were, when it was, like, cursed, you know, because all Horcruxes are cursed.
Right.
So I thought that it was going to, like, be, you know, whatever liquid you were going to put in it was going to taste disgusting or like poison you or give you hallucinations. Like, that's what I thought of when she asked that question.
That makes sense.
I definitely get the vibes of the potion in the cave that Dumbledore had to drink. I feel like you get cursed in that way if you drink out of the cup.
Oh no. Oh, woof. I mean, they never even fully explain what happened to Dumbledore there, but it sounds like a terrible situation.
Yeah, I would not want to go through that at all. It sounds really bad.
No, I never, ever want to have to go through that.
At Shell Cottage, Harry, Ron, and Hermione come up with the plan to break into Gringotts with Griffook the Goblin's help. Harry believes that a Horcrux is in the Lestrange's vault, and he is spot on. Once they get into Gringotts and into the vault, it gets super wild because there's, like, treasure and fancy things everywhere, and unfortunately there are Jimino and Flagrante curses in the vault, which means that everything will burn and multiply. So how would you guys feel being in this vault knowing that everything you touch will burn you and multiply?
I would leave.
Oh my god, Lewis.
I've burned my hand, like I've burned my wrist on a crappy IKEA pot that I had when I first moved to Seattle. And I still have a remnant of the scar to this day, like 4 years later. And it hurt at the time. I mean, and the scar is like gotten, like it's faded, but like I can still kind of see it when I look down at my wrist. I can't imagine being in an entire room of those pans that also multiply. Like, it seems, it's so bad. Searing hot metal, and then there's just more and more and more of it. I cannot stress enough how much that would be terrible. Awful.
I am personally scarred because when I lived in Illinois as a kid, my parents redid our basement and they didn't put the covers on the light switches yet. And I'm visually impaired. I can't see shit, basically. So I walked downstairs and I went go to turn on the light. And I'm telling you, I got so electrocuted. They didn't have to take me to the hospital or anything, but it hurt like hell for a really long time. And I didn't have a scar or anything, but electricity scares me. Burning scares me. I refuse to pour hot tea from a kettle because of this. So I actually just warm it up in the microwave. And so, like, electricity and burning scare me. And I'm also semi-claustrophobic. So that would be the thing that I would just send someone else in to do. Like, I would not do that at all.
Well, okay, I'm gonna share one of my burning stories because I have to jump on the train here. So, when I was really little, when we make Christmas cookies, we make these peanut butter ones that we put Hershey Kisses in the middle of. And so, I was tasked
Classic.
with putting the Hershey Kisses in the center. And because I was short, my like chin was like level with the countertop. And when I leaned over to put a Hershey Kiss in, I literally burned my chin. And it was the most terrible thing ever. It hurts so bad. So Harry tells everybody to look for Hufflepuff's cup or something that belonged to Ravenclaw. He spots the cup on a high shelf, and so the trio point their wands at it to put it in a three-way spotlight. It's out of reach, so Hermione does Levacorpus to boost Harry into the air, and he uses a Sword of Gryffindor to hook the cup onto the blade. So my question here is, why didn't the cup hop off the shelf? We know with Slytherin's locket that it freaked out when the sword was around, so why didn't the cup do the same?
I think it's just that not all of the Horcruxes are as powerful. I think some are stronger than the others. I don't think they all have necessarily the same curses in them and stuff like that. And that's why I've been saying throughout this episode that I feel like the cup is the most basic. It feels like the cup, and I would say the tiara too, because the tiara doesn't really do anything aside from exist. So I feel like there are some Horcruxes that are just as simple as it's got the soul in it, and that's all it is. I think there's just no extra evil on top of the cup, which is why it doesn't react.
This is probably the last one that he created and was like, yeah, I'm just gonna be lazy here and just put whatever I want in this cup and that's
I
it.
gotta get to seven. Go.
Yep, I made it to seven.
I also think that Hufflepuff's cup is the most chill because it belonged to Hufflepuff, the nicest one. She's not evil at all. So I think it makes sense that her object would be the most chill.
Valid.
It's true. Although you are biased.
Oh, shut up. So now let's talk about when it was destroyed. While Harry's off trying to figure out the whole diadem thing, Ron and Hermione go into the Chamber of Secrets.
Yep, this is terrible.
So when Harry finds Ron and Hermione, he's rightfully like, "Where the hell have you been?" And Ron's like, "Chamber of Secrets." And Hermione's like, "It was all Ron's idea. It was so brilliant." And so long story short, Ron spoke fake Parseltongue to go down into the Chamber of Secrets, and Hermione destroyed Hufflepuff's cup with a basilisk fang. This pisses me off so bad because you cannot learn Parseltongue. It's not something you can imitate. It's passed down through the Slytherins as like their signature talent or whatever. You can't just learn that, and there's no way Ron could have imitated it. So this makes me so mad, and I hope you guys don't want to fight me on this.
No, I
No,
agree with you.
absolutely
Like,
not.
it is not, Parseltongue is not a language. It is an ability. If you could learn to speak Parseltongue, Dumbledore would have learned it, Hermione would have learned it. And you can't just say noises that sound similar to stuff you've heard in the past and do it. It what always frustrated me more about this because like it just shouldn't work logistically, but also it is such an easy workaround for JK as an author to do. All she would have to do is have Harry go up to the gate with Ron and Hermione. He uses Parseltongue, let them in, and then he leaves. And there's such a simple solution that you could have done instead of this infuriating answer. And it's just so bothersome to me.
Yeah, it's like, you know, she can write Order of the Phoenix, which is the longest book in the series, but she has to shorten the like one of the best books in the series just because she doesn't want Harry to have to walk up to the gate. Like, come
Right,
on.
it's so easy.
This is like the Polyjuice potion all over again, you guys. That bothers me so much.
Well, I'm so happy we're in agreement that this is total bullshit. But Hufflepuff's cup is destroyed, and it's time to move on to the diadem.
The shiny ones. They're all shiny. Harry first sees the diadem in the Room of Hidden Things when he's hiding the Half-Blood Prince's book. Wanting to make sure he can find the book again, it says, "Seizing the chipped bust of an ugly old warlock from on top of a nearby crate, he stood it on top of the cupboard where the book was now hidden, perched a dusty old wig and a tarnished tiara on the statue's head to make it more distinctive. Then he leaves." So, what were your first impressions of the diadem?
So for me, I definitely didn't think much of it, to be honest, because it's this whole intense scene, like Harry's like trying to hide his Half-Blood Prince's book and he's in a hurry and he's like, okay, I'm gonna put it here and like put this tiara here so I know where to find it. So like it was super like quick and I didn't think anything of it. And as a mystery lover, I love how she planted this clue so like randomly, because looking back, it's such a cool reveal when we find out that it's actually a Horcrux.
Yeah, I thought it was a cool reveal. I definitely didn't see it coming. I didn't even realize it maybe until I was like either doing the prep for the podcast or even on the recording where someone told me like directly that it was the thing from before. So it took me by surprise. I obviously did not pick up on it in book six or whenever he sees it at first, like had no clue at all whatsoever. So I thought it was good. I thought it was very fun.
I definitely didn't pick up on it. I was just like, oh, a tiara, that's pretty. I also think it's interesting how some of these Horcruxes are just hidden in plain sight, but we don't hear more about them until Deathly Hallows. Like the ring and the diadem. We see them, we don't know what they are, and then we find this out in Deathly Hallows. It's like she planted this stuff, and she's like, oh, it's just gonna hit the fan later. You'll see. Just wait for publication date. Also, it's often said that some of the hardest things to find are in plain sight. So that really rings true here.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. It is like recently, last week, I was trying to find my keys before leaving the house to head to the Multitude studio, and I couldn't find them, and it took me so long to find them that I had to miss the ferry and had to take the next one that came 45 minutes later, and the keys were just like on a bookshelf that I had placed there because I was like, ah, this bookshelf is in plain sight, so I won't forget where I placed my keys. And it came back to bite me in the butt.
Happens all the time with my phone. I lose my phone like 5 times a day.
Yeah, fortunately you can call it. I wish I could call my keys.
Oh my gosh. So what I found super interesting is that Voldemort hid it in the Room of Hidden Things because that room is full of junk. And it can't be like seen as a special place to him. I know Hogwarts was, but to hide it there, it's like full of junk and anybody could have just walked in and grabbed a Horcrux.
I mean, I think it's a good hiding spot just in the fact that there is so much clutter. It's like he hid it in the middle of an I Spy book. There's just so much other stuff going on. It's like, where's Waldo of the diadem? I think it's a smart decision.
Yeah, but the thing too, and Ron points it out, is Harry's like, oh, he hid it here because he didn't think anybody knew about the Room of Requirement. And Ron has this remark later about how like, why the heck would he think that? Like, look at all this junk here. Like, people knew about the Room of Requirement.
Yeah, it's weirdly, like, it was actually a terrible... I forgot about that, so I'm glad you brought it up. Like, it was actually a terrible decision by Voldemort, but it ended up... It was such a bad choice that it came around and actually was an amazing choice.
I agree.
Yeah. During the Battle of Hogwarts, Harry talks to Helena Ravenclaw, and he learns that basically she stole the diadem from her mom and hid it in a forest in Albania. And she told Voldemort about it because he was charming. And, well, that didn't work out for her or for him because the diadem is now a Horcrux. So Harry realizes, hey, if Voldy took it when he was younger, then he must have hidden it in the Room of Requirement because I saw it there, and he must have hidden it when he came back to ask for the teaching post, and in his haste and annoyance that he didn't get it, he's like, I'm just gonna leave a piece of my soul because I lived at Hogwarts for so long, and here you go. So Harry runs up to the Room of Requirement and he catches up with Ron and Hermione and basically tells them the whole story, and they have to clear out the room because Neville's grandmother, Ginny, and Tonks are in there, and they can't use it unless it's vacant. So They get up there and Harry thinks, I need the place where everything is hidden. And the trio step inside of the room of hidden things. Hermione tries summoning the diadem, but this doesn't work. Luckily, Harry knows where it is. The trio split up to search. Just as Harry finds the diadem, he's cornered by Malfoy, Crabbe, and Goyle. A battle ensues. Crabbe goes rogue and tries to kill everyone, while Malfoy actually tries to stop him, saying that they need this diadem for Voldemort and that Voldemort wants Harry alive. Malfoy never even throws a spell at Harry, which is interesting. Crabbe ends up creating the Fiend Fire, which turns into flaming serpents, chimeras, and dragons, which are out to kill everybody. The trio lose Malfoy and crew and are surrounded. Harry finds some broomsticks and climbs on one while Ron and Hermione are on the other. Harry finds Malfoy and the stunned Goyle on top of some charred desks. Harry took Malfoy on his broom while Ron and Hermione took Goyle. Harry retrieves the diadem from midair and they all get out. Sadly, Crabbe is dead. The trio look at the diadem. The diadem was hot and blackened with soot, and you could just make out the tiny words etched upon it. Wit beyond measure is man's greatest treasure. A blood-like substance, dark and tarry, seemed to be leaking from the diadem. Suddenly, Harry felt the thing vibrate violently, then break apart in his hands, and as it did so, he thought he heard the faintest, most distant scream of pain, echoing not from the grounds or the castle, but from the thing that had just fragmented in his fingers. Hermione tells them that fiendfire destroys horcruxes, case in point. What do you think of the fiendfire in general and its ability to destroy horcruxes?
It's bad. It shouldn't have existed. I think having fiendfire is okay, but for it to be a horcrux destroyer, I think is such a plot hole because Hermione ends up revealing that like she knew about it, but since you can't trust it, since it's so unruly, she didn't bring it up to Harry and Ron. And they tried so many ways to destroy the locket that you would think they had no hope of finding the sword. They didn't know any of this stuff. They would have tried it at least once. And I think it is so silly, especially because they had basilisk fangs that they could have used to destroy the tiara. So again, just like the Ron Parseltongue thing, JK made it like unnecessarily hard on herself and added this thing that just raises even more questions. I think the fiendfire could have existed on its own and everything could have been the same. And then rather than it destroy the horcrux, they just take out a basilisk fang that they got and then boom, and then that's it. And you're good. And we don't have these weird questions of how come they didn't try it? How come Hermione didn't work to try to make it less unruly? It was so frustrating.
Yeah, I totally get you. And in terms of Hermione knowing about it, I feel like she was just being her sensible self, because I guarantee you, if she would have been like, hey, Harry and Ron, like, there's this cursed fire that can destroy horcruxes, they would have been like, let's try it, you know? So I feel like Hermione was doing the safe thing by not bringing that up. But in terms of, like, JK writing this, like, we see the Sword of Gryffindor being used multiple times. Basilisk fangs were used multiple times. So I feel like she didn't want to keep repeating things. So on her part, bringing the fiend fire in as a method of destruction added some variety. But I definitely think it could have been handled differently.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it almost seemed like this Horcrux was totally pointless, because, like, what's Voldemort going to do with the tiara? He's just going to wear it? Like, he's not a queen. Like, he's supposed to be king. And it's just like, why is this a Horcrux? And we learn nothing about Ravenclaw House up until book 7. Like, he doesn't even know who the heck the Grey Lady is until he walks up to her. He's like, you're the Grey Lady? And she's like, yeah. It's like, you know, he's passed her in the corridors, but they do Ravenclaw dirty because you know nothing about this house. And then all of a sudden he goes in there and it's destroyed. And he didn't even need to catch it on his way out to figure out what was going on. Hermione could have just said, hey, it was destroyed by the fiendfire. You didn't even need to catch it like a boss. Like, it's gone anyway. And also it just makes me angry because this is supposed to be a really cool artifact and this is all that we see of it. Also, what do you guys think would happen if he put it on? Like, obviously we know it gives you wisdom, but like, when it was cursed, what do you think would happen if Harry put it on?
Dark magic wisdom.
Oh, maybe it gives you wisdom. It teaches you the things that you don't want to know, like things you wish you didn't
no, like your favorite author is actually a TERF, stuff like that.
I definitely think there would be dark magic wisdom going on, because when you put the diadem on, it's supposed to make you rise, and being a Horcrux as well, it would make you rise in a very dark and evil way.
Or it's just cursed like the ring and it gives you a year to live. Mm.
So now let's talk about the next Horcrux, which is the one in Harry James Potter, our favorite hero. So at the end of Deathly Hallows, Harry goes into the Pensieve with Snape's memories, and while in the Pensieve, he overhears a very shocking conversation between Dumbledore and Snape. Dumbledore tells Snape that when Voldemort tried to kill Harry, the killing curse rebounded upon Voldemort. And when this happened, a piece of Voldemort's soul broke away, or blasted away, from the hole and latched itself onto Harry. This means that as long as the piece of Voldemort's soul remains in Harry, Voldemort cannot die. And therefore, Harry must die, and Voldemort has to be the one to do it. So how would you feel if you were Harry, basically being told you have to die because a piece of Voldemort's soul is inside you?
I mean, it would be very scary for sure. But I think with Harry, like, especially at this point, he understands that he's been thrust into a role that is, he's more than just him. Like, he has to consider the fate of humanity in terms of what his life does. So, like, it's hard to take. And it was honestly the most impressive thing for me, because I was pretty critical of Harry until this moment where he just kind of rolls with it and accepts it and doesn't become selfish in this moment. And I think that that's pretty powerful for him to be able just to basically be thrust with the weight of the world on his shoulders, and he just decides, okay. And I think that was very impressive for a teenager. It would be very easy for someone 17 years old to be like, no, I don't want to die. I don't care if everybody lives because of it, blah, blah, blah. Like, really mature decision. So I was very, very impressed with how well Harry took that.
I definitely agree with you. It brings out his maturity and also his Gryffindor qualities, because it takes a lot of courage and selflessness to walk to your own death. And also knowing that you're doing it for the greater good. And that's kind of something that Harry kind of got from Dumbledore with the whole Grindelwald thing. It was all for the greater good. And Harry kind of took that on as his own mindset. So it shows a lot about who he is. And he's definitely a hero.
Yeah, for sure. I'd also feel like, you know, as anybody facing death would feel, bummed. Because it's like, oh, I was born famous. I didn't ask to be famous. I didn't ask to be the one who had to defeat the Dark Lord. But here I am. You know, this really stinks. At least I had a good time while I was on Earth. You know, at least I had some friends. At least I had some good times, had some laughs. And I feel like that's what you have to be like when you face death. You have to think about, well, at least I had this time with everybody. And right. If I'm going to do it for the greater good, then I'm going to do it for the greater good. And that is really
Don't
admirable, like you were saying.
Don't cry because it's over. Smile because it happened.
Yes.
The Harry Potter approach.
Exactly. So Harry is very heroic, and he goes to the Forbidden Forest to die. It's touching because he's able to walk into the forest with his loved ones by his side from using the resurrection stone that was in the Snitch. But once he faces Voldemort and Voldemort casts Avada Kedavra, he ends up in Wizard Purgatory that looks like King's Cross Station, with Dumbledore and a disgusting baby-like creature that is what Voldemort would become. After a very long and deep conversation with Dumbledore, it's revealed that Harry has the choice to return to his world. And he does so, thus fulfilling the prophecy and giving the love protection to everybody at the castle that Lily gave to him when she died to protect him. So I'm curious to see what you guys think about Harry having a second chance at life, and also that Voldemort had to be the one to destroy the Horcrux.
I think it makes sense, given all that we know about Horcruxes. It would make sense that the person who set up the evil is the one that has to do it. I remember at first, like, having to sit down and do all of the mental math of, like, oh, well, if this part of his soul is in here and then he doesn't really kill him. Like, I remember at first it took me a little bit to draw all the lines and all of that. But eventually, you know, I get where it is. And I think it is a cool, and it feels like a very fitting way for that to go about in the end of the series. And after all the Horcrux finding and destroying that takes place.
I agree. It took me a really long time to understand the prophecy. But I really like it because it's full circle. The creator has to destroy his creation, and Harry was his creation. And that's how it had to be. But I think it's beautiful that Harry got a second chance at life. I think it was an awesome way to make sure that the fans of the books didn't murder the author because Harry died.
No.
It was also a cop-out sort of deal, but and it was just a true coming of age story because there's so many choices and quests that go into the Harry Potter series that this was just the final decision.
I definitely agree with both of you that there's a lot of significance behind Voldemort being the one to destroy the Horcrux, and the prophecy has always fascinated me. I was always super curious about the whole neither can live while the other survives thing. So I think the way that's all wrapped up is very nice. And also, I want to point out that the Horcrux in Harry died, not Harry. So essentially, Avada Kedavra was able to kill a Horcrux, which I find super fascinating.
Yeah, because this was the first instance where a Horcrux wasn't an object, it was a person. So therefore, it's an unforgivable curse. So it makes sense that that could be a thing, but you couldn't just do it on an object. Like, because that curse is for killing a person. And if the Horcrux happens to be in the person, that makes sense, but you can't just do it on an object because it's already semi-dead.
I wonder what would happen if you tried it on an object.
Probably nothing.
It'd be really interesting to see, though, if somebody were to try it. So let's flash back to Sorcerer's Stone. During Harry's sorting, the Sorting Hat really wanted to sort him into Slytherin, but Harry kept begging, "Not Slytherin! Not Slytherin!" So the Sorting Hat gave in and put him in Gryffindor instead. But do you guys think that it was the Horcrux in Harry that gave the Sorting Hat major Slytherin vibes, or was it just Harry's personality?
I feel like Harry, personality-wise, is much more of a Gryffindor than he is a Slytherin. I think the only thing that really is Slytherin-y about Harry is that he can speak Parseltongue, and I'm pretty sure that is there because of the soul thing. So I would lean towards the soul being what the hat saw.
Yeah, because the cat has been around for so many years and it's very powerful. I bet it saw into Harry's soul and saw the Slytherin tendencies. And speaking to the Slytherin tendencies, it's kind of funny how it took until the last book for us to realize, oh, Harry being a Horcrux makes sense. He can speak Parseltongue. He is a half-blood like the Dark Lord, although that wasn't planned. He has all of these abilities. And it's like, oh, these were just little hints, and it all makes sense now. That was a cool end of the puzzle.
I completely agree with both of you that it was a Horcrux that gave the hat Slytherin vibes. But just think if the hat was super smart and it knew that was a Horcrux. And when Harry put it on his head, it was like, "You're a Horcrux, Harry." He's just like Hagrid, like, "Harry, you're a wizard." Imagine like how Harry would have been like, "Wait, what are you talking about?"
Yeah, and then it could have ended there, it'd be like cut to black. That'd be pretty funny, to be honest.
Honestly, that would have been hilarious.
Okay, so to round it out, Nagini. So Nagini, I mean, we first see Nagini when the snake attacks Frank. I believe that's our introduction to Nagini, which is terrifying. But we eventually there is the theory Dumbledore believes that he thinks that Nagini is going to be a Horcrux based on how the relationship between Nagini and Voldemort is, but it's nothing confirmed. It's just a hunch that Dumbledore has to go off on. Eventually, later, we're able to learn that that is it, and that we are going to have to kill Nagini in order to bring down Voldemort. But and it's confirmed, especially because Voldemort starts panicking when all the Horcruxes are getting destroyed, and then puts Nagini into this sphere. I was very sad that that wasn't brought together in the movie because I thought it was very funny that Nagini was put into like this sparkly ball, and I would have loved to have seen the snake in the ball. But I guess the movie decided it was very ridiculous, which it is. But I wanted to see it, so Nagini's in that protective magical sphere, and then of course the final wonderful moment is when Neville just d beheads Nagini with the Sword of Gryffindor in a very, very cool scene that was not that whole, the whole ending of the eighth movie was such a letdown, because I think the ending of the seventh book was written so perfectly that it was very disappointing that there was all sorts of things changed and made different and made less intense. And I think the Nagini death is one of them. But in the book, it is awesome. It's really cool to see Neville be a member of the team, especially because Harry trusted Neville to tell him, you know, didn't go full-fledged explaining Horcruxes, but was like, look, you gotta kill the snake, trust me. So I like that Neville was able to have this moment, because he's had such a tough life, but he's still trying to help Harry out and help the cause, and he gets to have this big shining moment, and it is so cool for him to have it. And it was surprising. Like, when it happened in the book, I was genuinely very shocked. I thought it was awesome and very well done, and like a cool action scene description. And it's very interesting from the perspective of, even before we learn that Harry is a Horcrux, when Dumbledore suggests it to Harry that Nagini is, that's supposed to be a big shocking thing. Like, whoa, a living thing could be a Horcrux? That is already supposed to be this big whoa moment. Eventually, Harry being it is an even bigger reveal. But I always thought it was pretty cool. Of course, all of this is with the caveat that I am not believing / agreeing with what the prequel movies Crimes of Grindelwald did with Nagini, because I think that creates a whole mess of problems from lore to representation to everything. So I'm just not even going to touch on that. But just in the books, the fact that Dumbledore has kind of made his pet henchman sidekick into a Horcrux is pretty cool. Especially, it's very scary when you have to go about, like, it's smart strategy from Voldemort, like, oh, you're going to try to kill this Horcrux? It's a giant deadly snake. Good luck. So very smart on Voldemort's perspective. But the fact that Neville is able to do it is so cool. I love it.
It is cool, but it makes me wonder again how the heck he created Nagini, like, as a Horcrux. You know, it's like, because who did he murder to make her a Horcrux? And, or did she have to murder someone to make herself a Horcrux? Like, how did that work? And it brings up the question of, okay, well, if he Avada Kedavra'd her, again, would that work? But the sword is much more dramatic, because the two houses clash here with the whole snake, Slytherin, and sword thing. And it's also great because it's Neville, and it makes me always think about how if it wasn't Harry who was the chosen guy, it would have been Neville. So it's like Neville could have been a Horcrux, so he'd be destroying a fellow Horcrux. Like, that's what I think of.
So I could go on for hours about Neville being the one to kill Nagini, because he's my favorite character. I adore him, and he deserved this kind of time to shine. And I think it's really interesting, because even though Neville's not the chosen one, he was still intertwined with the prophecy. So it was nice to see him kind of play his role. But in terms of Nagini being a Horcrux as an animal, that's really fascinating to me, because we see with Harry that he had connections to Voldemort, like being able to see into his mind, experiencing his emotions, speaking Parsifal tongue, etc. And I think, like, Voldemort turning her, Nagini, into a Horcrux is really interesting, because she is a snake. And obviously Slytherin and Dark Arts and stuff, like, that's so closely tied to the snakes. And so it makes sense that he would choose her as a Horcrux. But, like, would she be able to see into his mind? And would they have, like, a stronger connection in the sort of way that Harry had with Voldemort?
Oh, yeah. I think so. Because when Harry has that vision of the snake killing Arthur, it's like Voldemort just, like, slipped into her head as she was doing it, so he could see through her eyes what was going on, because he, you know, so I feel like he definitely had that communication. And I feel like him also having the snake as a Horcrux made him more snake-like. Like, my question has always been, could he feel her moods too? Like she could probably feel him. Could he feel her moods? And, like, could he get the pleasure of the snake, like, when the snake's eating someone? Like, is that a thing? Something to think about. Something real.
Or to not think about, so we don't get freaked out.
or not.
And also the question too is, like, how the heck did the snake become the old lady? How did that work? No one has ever answered my question. Like, how did...
With Bethilda?
How did...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, how did... I don't get it.
Yeah, I don't know. How did Nagini get inside her?
So that's why I asked Mike to do the snake.
I mean, yeah, I don't know. That was always a confusing thing. I guess you can just be like, magic, I guess, as an answer. It's pretty tried and true method that lets you rationalize a lot of the strange things that happen in this series.
It's definitely terrifying, though.
Oh, for sure. Terrifying. That's pretty much it. I mean, I think it's an interesting Horcrux. I like that Dumbledore's theory came true. Makes me feel good for him and his detective work. So, yeah, I mean, very, very scary. Smart decision from Voldemort. Awesome, awesome heroic moment from Neville. And just a very cool moment in the book. What's interesting with the Nagini thing is, like, you see Voldemort get nervous when he's threatened by the fact that Nagini's the only one left, and then you see Voldemort get even more nervous when Nagini dies. That's just a whole nother level. So the safety of Nagini is really tied to Voldemort's sense of security about the situation. So it's fun to see him go from oh no to oh no. It's interesting.
It definitely is interesting. And what I'm thinking about now is, like, after Voldemort cast Avada Kedavra and thought Harry was dead, he took Nagini out of her magical sphere and put her around his shoulder. Then he was like, all right, Nagini, we're all good now. Harry's dead. No more magical sphere for you. But honestly, like, knowing that that's still a Horcrux, like, as Voldemort, I would still want to keep her as safe as possible. So, like, why would he take her out of the magical sphere? He still want to protect her. He should.
Because you're Voldemort and you got to flex whenever you can flex because you're so full of yourself.
They always say that arrogance was one of his greatest faults, and it shows here.
Definitely.
So that brings us to the end of our fabulous Horcrux discussion. But before we go, I wanted to ask you guys, what is your favorite Horcrux and why?
Oh God, I don't know anymore. My answer changed.
I would go with the locket because I think that the evil magic around it, from making people feel worse to giving you your worst memory to being afraid of death, I feel like it is one of the strongest and most interesting ones, especially unlike Nagini, which already is a very scary, terrifying thing. To have something as innocent as a locket become so evil, and also I think the way the movie did the locket is so cool that I think the locket is my favorite.
I'd have to agree with you. I love the locket too. A close second would be Hufflepuff's cup because my house object, and I love this scene in Gringotts. Mm-hmm. I think it's awesome and it's one of my favorite scenes. But in terms of the locket, I think the locket is very interesting because it's the one we spend the most time with during the whole camping, during Deathly Hallows, and seeing the trio take turns wearing it. You really get to see the darkness surrounding that one in particular. So I think that's one of the main reasons why I think that one's so fascinating, because we get to learn so much about it.
I agree. We definitely do spend the most time with the locket. When I originally picked the Horcruxes that I did, I was like, oh, the ring is, like, really interesting, and oh, the diadem. But just through our discussion, like, I honestly, it's a tie for me between the diary and the locket, just because the diary is just so fascinating to me. I mean, I'm a book lover, and so the fact that it was, like, changed in such a fashion just fascinates me. But the locket is probably the scariest of them all, aside from the snake, for me. Mm-hmm. So I definitely, it's a tie between the diary and the locket, although the locket would be the coolest Horcrux to, like, buy off the Noble Collection, I would say. Like, if I was gonna buy one, I'd buy that one.
The ring would be pretty cool too.
Yeah. Well, that brings us to the end of our episode. Mike, it was an honor having you. How did you like being on? And what can you tell our listeners about what you're up to and your podcast?
Sure. It was great. Thank you so much for having me. I had a fun time. It was nice. I've never really done, like, a deep dive just on the Horcruxes, so that's very exciting. And the Horcruxes were always a very special moment to me doing the podcast, because I really got excited about the plot, and I could feel, like, the show was really popular at that point in time, so there was, like, a whole crowd of people. It was like I was inside a room with a bunch of windows, and everyone was, like, looking at me, trying to be like, what's he gonna do? And no one told me what any of the plot twists were, so Horcruxes were a really fun moment in making the show. So it was fun to kind of look at them with a new lens here. So yeah, thanks for having me. As far as stuff that I have going on, if you're listening to this before April 30th of 2021, that means there's a Kickstarter live for a new podcast project that I'm hoping to launch. That podcast is Modern Muckraker. It's a scripted show. It's a comedic investigative journalism podcast. I'm going to be playing a character who is fully convinced that he is completing the world's most important research and uncovering the hidden truths behind pop culture's most burning questions. But in reality, these questions are going to be things like, when should Spider-Man take the subway instead of web swinging? So my team and I will do like super intense research. We're going to go really over the top to do exact research to find the answers. I want to get interviews with highly overqualified people to answer them. So for this Spider-Man one, I would talk with people that work in Marvel to understand Spider-Man. I would talk with physicists to like make an equation for how web swinging works based on building height. And then I would interview people that work for the New York City Metro Transit Authority to get all the accurate information about the subway. And then through rigorous research, we will arrive at a definitive answer for all of the questions. So in this case, it would be like Spider-Man should take the subway on these days at this time through this part of town, stuff like that. So I've got a couple different question ideas. And the reason we're doing a Kickstarter versus something like a Patreon or hoping ad money comes in is I want to bring in a whole team. So this will involve writers, a producer, a sound designer, and more. And I want to be able to pay these people up front what they're worth rather than have people work on it and then be like, yeah, if the show does well and we get Patreon money or ad money, etc. So that's why Kickstarter is the more apt funding for us to use. So if you want to support it, you can go to bit.ly/modernmuckraker, and that'll take you directly to the Kickstarter, or you can go to modernmuck.com and learn about the show, or if you're listening to this past April 30th and you want to see what's up, you can go to modernmuck.com. So that's what I've got going on right now.
Fabulous. And also, guys, go listen to Podlist because it is amazing and it's so funny.
Thank you. I'm very biased, but I also think it's a very good show. No, thanks for the pleasure was all mine. This was a good time, and thank you for having me on the show.
Yeah, thank you. We are huge fans, and especially me. I don't know how to maintain my fangirlness and act cool. So I'm proud that I've been acting cool this whole time.
You've done a very good job. You've done very, very well. You didn't hyperventilate once.
Well, thank you guys so much for listening. Our next episode comes out on May 14th, so stay tuned for that. Thanks again. Bye.
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 Thank you for listening to this chapter of The Half-Blood Princesses, a Harry Potter podcast.
Hedwig's theme and Leaving Hogwarts in this episode were originally composed by John Williams and arranged by me. Until next time, mark this page with a magical bookmark.